Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us in studio this evening Joan Paris, who attended the Millennium Conference in the year 2000 in New York and the Millennium 2000 Plus 5 Conference that was held just this last month in New York City once again. But before we get to talking to John about what happened there, I want to point out that this weekend on CBS 60 Minutes, they had an interview with Elian Gonzalez. You remember a little Elian Gonzalez? I think it was just shortly before George Bush became president, probably 1999, when Elian had come from Cuba, his mother, and I think 13 or 14 other people had all perished. He was the only survivor. He was just floating on an inner tube. The rest of them had risked their lives to get away from the tyranny of communist Cuba. I mean, if this weren't a terrible place, I mean, literally millions of Cubans wouldn't have risked their lives to cross that 90 miles of shark-infested water to come to the United States, but they all perished except Elian, who was, of course, taken in by his in-laws, pardon me, by his relatives. His uncle was there, his father's brother. In fact, his father had actually called the brother to tell them that the boy was going to be coming. He, of course, had remarried was separated from his first wife. But he certainly would like to have come himself, but he wasn't able to get away. After all, if you try to escape, why, they will take you back and torture you or kill you or do all sorts of terrible things to the people who try to escape from this communist bastion. And had Elian been picked up by the U.S. Coast Guard there on the inner tube, he would have been, of course, taken back to Cuba. Because nobody is to be allowed to escape from Cuba. Well, the program that they had on 60 Minutes on Sunday evening was really rather fascinating because it was a straight communist party line program. Little Elian can't speak English, and the people who were doing the interviews couldn't speak Spanish, so everything was done through an interpreter. Elian, of course, would not dare say that he'd rather be in the United States. Why, that would bring terrible punishment on his family and certainly on him. And, of course, he wouldn't dare say it anyway. After all, he's a celebrity in Cuba. But here's a little boy who is a political pawn. Now, the issue, you know, has been brought up. Did Elian want to go back to Cuba? Did he want to come to the United States and live here with his uncle after his mother had died, trying to escape from the communist bastion? And there were people talking on both sides. And as so often is the case on television programs here in the United States, they never talk about what the real issue is. The issue is not, did Elian want to stay in the United States? Did he want to go back? Did his father really want him to go back? Was his father forced to say what the brutal dictator of Cuba wants? No, the issue really is, why was it that Bill Clinton and Janet Reno, the Attorney General, sent 125 heavily armed men to Miami during the very time they were negotiating and talking on the phone to the family, who thought that they might be able to negotiate some sort of a peaceful settlement? They had 125 troops who suddenly broke into the home and kidnapped Elian, took him to the Aspen Institute, which is a CFR think tank in Colorado, and then sent him back to Cuba. Now, the reason this was done, to build up the prestige of Fidel Castro. Why would Bill Clinton and Janet Reno want to build up the prestige of Fidel Castro? There was no basis in international law for this. But this was, of course, to build up Castro's reputation, not only in Cuba, but throughout the world, to strike fear in the heart of anybody who wanted to try to escape, because it was very obvious that the United States government was working hand in glove with Fidel Castro to people in Cuba, but not obvious to people here in the United States. You see, people really don't understand what goes on in Cuba. They do not understand that it was the American State Department that brought Fidel Castro to power back in 1959. I know because I talked to the American ambassador, Earl Smith, who was there at the time, and he told me that that Fidel Castro was known to be a communist. Ambassador Smith knew he was a communist. Our State Department knew he was a communist. And we brought him intentionally to power. In fact, Ambassador Smith was ordered to talk to President Batista, who had incidentally been democratically elected to power in Cuba in 1956, I guess it was, or 1955, something like that. Anyway, he was at the end of his term, but he had been democratically elected to office in 1956, and he was going to be leaving in 1959. Be that as it may, why the American government ordered him to leave the country, knowing full well it would be turned over to Fidel Castro. What people do not understand is that communism is not a concept of redistributing the wealth of the poor, redistributing the wealth of the rich. It is a concept that is imposed on the people by the wealthy. It is a vehicle of getting around duly representative government and establishing a new power elite. It is not simply by coincidence that David Rockefeller, the richest man in the United States, his two daughters are both dedicated Marxists and supporters of Fidel Castro. Do you think they support Fidel Castro because he's going to redistribute their money or take their money away from them? Of course not. They are elitist, and so is Fidel Castro, and that's what you have. Under communism, you have rule by the elite. If you read David Rockefeller's book, his memoirs, and they are available, they were published just about 2 years ago, you'll find that David Rockefeller has had not one but several meetings with that brutal communist dictator, Fidel Castro. Why would the richest capitalist in the United States hold meetings with the wicked Fidel Castro? Why, very, very simply. They are both elitists. They both want control. And that's the name of the game. And that, of course, takes us to what we're talking about this evening, is the move towards the New World Order and the New World Religion. And we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest in studio this evening, Joan Paris. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and as I was just explaining to our listeners, why communism, stripped of all of its idealism and Marxism and verbiage, is really an elitist concept. There are those who desire power. And who has more power than the ruler of a communist or a socialist country? No one. And there is basically there is no relationship between communism or socialism and freedom. And it was de Tocqueville who basically said that, you know, that socialism and democracy have one word in common. One, of course, democracy wants equality. They have the one word in common, which is equality. In a democracy, we want equality and freedom. In socialism, we want equality under a tyranny. That's what it's all about. Everybody is equal under the tyrannical state. Well, Joan, you were at the meeting there just this last month in in New York City, where the leaders of the world were gathered together, working towards bringing about a one-world government under a new ruling elite. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your impression of what you witnessed?
Well, thank you for that introduction, Dr. Stan. You're eloquent, and I just appreciate the work that you do so diligently for hours every day that you've done for years, because there are not that many people bringing this information to the public. There were thousands of journalists accredited to attend this global meeting, which was billed as the largest ever gathering of heads of state in the world. But the average American didn't hear much, if anything, about what was done and about the tax that's going to end up on their airplane tickets that was agreed to. And, you know, since you opened with Elian Gonzalez, when I'm at the UN in New York, I like to go through the bookstore. And, you know, we talk about children and, you know, our precious, innocent children. They should not be manipulated. They should not be used. But I was curious as I was browsing at the United Nations bookstore to find quite a bit of material that was directed at school children. And I know from my attendance at the Millennium Summit 5 years ago that there is an office next to the Department of Information for school teachers, where thousands of school teachers can come for training, indoctrination, and for materials to use in our schools. One of the little books I decided to buy was an intermediate school kit of the United Nations, and it's for teachers to use at the intermediate grade levels. And I'm a musician myself. I like music, and I was interested back in the 21st chapter of this book, how they use music for children. And again, this is kind of a textbook for teachers. And there was an artist named Benjamin Britten who lived from 1913 to 1976, and he helped eulogize the 20th anniversary of the United Nations. And one of the exercises for children is to describe this man's beliefs. Of course, he was a staunch supporter, one who loved the United Nations. And then it asked children to compose their own protest song with a message of peace. And then there are chants with the piano music, the vocal music here. And one of the chants that they have for children is, the strong and mighty topple from their place, the supple and weak rise above them all.
And, of course, that is this this common misconception that these ideas of socialism are going to topple the very, very powerful and give the weak and the impoverished a better chance. Whereas, actually, all of these ideas are being imposed from the top down by people of great wealth.
And, unfortunately, they've been being implemented for decades and decades in our school systems. And this type of indoctrination is what's molding and breaking down and destroying our children.
Because they really don't understand that liberty and limited government are synonymous, and that tyranny and total government are synonymous, and the people of great wealth and great power want all power in government, not to be used to regulate them, but to regulate the common people.
And so it says, you know, to perform these musical extracts, and it asks, do your feelings change once you've heard and performed the music? What's your personal reaction to the anthem as a whole? So there are all kinds of ways that our children are being indoctrinated, and these are psychological techniques of imprinting.
And they're being used all across America. In fact, indeed, all across the world.
All around the world.
It's part of bringing everybody into this idea that, oh, if we only had this one world government, why then there would be peace and there would be prosperity for all. What they do not understand is the real purpose is to bring about tyranny for everyone except for the ruling elite. And that is why the leaders of the world and the most powerful and wealthy people in the world back this whole idea, because it's all about bringing about a new ruling class, a new ruling elite. But you cannot let the common people know that. And certainly you cannot let the children know that. Many who will spend their whole lives dedicated to this idea of remaking society and bringing about a socialist or Marxist society, not understanding that David Rockefeller's two daughters are both dedicated Marxists, and they don't want to redistribute their wealth. They want to take your freedom.
And Dr. Stan, if there are any of our listeners that haven't completely figured out this agenda, then there's a little key, there's a little help that you can use to understand when this new world order is being imposed. What I have found traveling around the world is that everything that you find in scriptures from the Old Testament to the New Testament, you'll find scriptures and concepts taken out of that great book and completely reversed. And so one of the songs that's in here says, if you have ears to hear, then hear. And, of course, that comes out of the Holy Scriptures of the Judeo-Christian ethic. And so that is used.
But of course, one of the big things that in all of our schools, the purpose of education is to destroy the child's faith in God. And the reason they want to do that is if you don't have faith in God, then of course you'll look to government for leadership.
And this book, unlike our school textbooks, has the preamble to the United Nations Charter. Our children aren't learning our Constitution and Bill of Rights and the founding documents, but the United Nations Charter and the preamble is included to indoctrinate them. And, of course, the preamble states that the United Nations is determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. And, of course, this was adopted in June 26th of 1945. In San Francisco, and we can see, you know, how effective they've been.
Well, of course, what people do not understand is that all of the wars of the 20th century and even the wars of the latter part of the 19th century were brought about by these people who wanted a world government. They used war to change society. They used war to create such carnage and horror that people would be willing to give up their national sovereignty to embrace this idea of world government. And the very people who created the bloodiest wars of all history are the very people who today are pushing the United Nations.
And Dr. Stan, I think it would be worthwhile to spend a couple of minutes looking at what the preamble to the United Nations Charter promises, because it's in draconian contrast to what they have delivered and what they are in the process of delivering. It says that this United Nations is to reaffirm the dignity and worth of the human person. And, you know, there's so many countries where there have been mass genocides, especially in Africa.
Well, I think Rwanda is a perfect example of what the United Nations is. And, I'm going to be interviewing the general, the Canadian general who was there. I'm reading his book today. His book is Shake Hands with the Devil. And he described what he saw there. And he described when he came back, and some minister said to him, "General, how can you believe in God after what you saw in Rwanda?" And his reply was, "I believe in God because when I was in Rwanda, I shook hands with the devil. He recognized it was evil. He recognized the United Nations had prevented him from doing what needed to be done. Kofi Annan, who today is the Secretary General of the United Nations, had specifically ordered him not to intervene, not to try to save the 800,000 people were slaughtered under the auspices of this organization that supposedly is there to end war and violence and bring happiness to all people. But ask the people of Rwanda what they think of the United Nations, and ask the Canadian General, General Roméo Dallaire, what he thinks of the United Nations. He served under them, and it almost cost him his sanity."
It's amazing. And there's a movie that you can get called Hotel Rwanda that will... It will frame this conversation in different terms, but towards the end it shows the person who was in charge of all of these refugees calling the United Nations, although they show him calling his company in Switzerland. And he was completely ignored. They were not allowed to use any type of self-protection to prevent the slaughter of these people.
Well, the first thing they did, of course, was to disarm everybody in Rwanda, just like they're trying to disarm the people in the United States today, as they tried to disarm the people in New Orleans. And only when the people were disarmed and were they able to move ahead with their genocide, they knew exactly what they were doing. And as they disarmed the people in Armenia before the Armenian Holocaust, as they disarmed the people in Russia before the Russian Holocaust, as they disarmed the people in China before the Chinese Holocaust, as they disarmed the people, certainly in Germany, before the Holocaust there, so it was that in Rwanda, they disarmed the people before they slaughtered, hacked to death, about 800,000 people. And, of course, what people have missed was not because they were black that nobody was concerned. It was because they were Christians that nobody was concerned. And nobody mentions that this was a Christian issue, and they were intent upon slaughtering the Christians. But, of course, we wouldn't want to mention that to the people here in America, would we? Might make them realize who might be next.
The preamble to the United Nations Charter says that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest.
I mean, like in Iraq today, is that the kind of common interest? Because this is authorized by the United Nations.
Well, this is fundamental to know what they mean by these words. Armed force shall not be used save in the common interest and to employ international machinery for the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all peoples. And what they mean by that, Dr. Stan, and this is fundamental to what is being implemented, the common interest is the development of all of the natural resources and the wealth of the world by a very select few. So common interest is a collectivist principle or concept that's being used really to enslave the common person aside from this very small elite.
In fact, it really, the people have to know that in Zaire today, there's a civil war that's been going on for a decade. About 3 million people have been slaughtered there. We never mention that here in the United States, but 3 million people have been slaughtered. The United Nations forces are there. And what are they doing? Well, in part they're guarding the mines and the other things that are owned by Westerners, but they're not stopping the war. Because, of course, you've got communist units coming in from Angola, and, of course, Angola is financed by Chevron oil company and by the United States government. We're keeping the communist government in power there, Northwest Africa. And, of course, we installed a communist government there. Rhodesia, under Zimbabwe, they call it Zimbabwe today, under Mugabe, Robert Mugabe, we put Robert Mugabe into power. He was brought to power by the American State Department and the British State Department. We always work together, bringing tyranny to these countries. And we insist on putting Marxists into power, but we can't let the American people know that the major thrust of American foreign policy has never been to defeat communism. It has always been to have communism as the best enemy money could buy, so that we would be able to rally the people behind the government so they'd pay their taxes, so they'd support the largest military establishment in the world. And the United States today pays more money for our military than the next 20 countries in the world spend for their military all combined. Well, why are we have such a powerful military? Because the major purpose of our military is not to defend America, but to bring the New World Order and the New World Religion. That is because our government has been taken over by people who have a different world vision, who worship a different God.
And that's so well summed up in the statement of President Hu Jintao of China, and of course all of the world leaders have time to make a statement, and most of them put out a press release or a transcript of the speech that they give on the United Nations floor. And this one from the President of China says that China is the world's largest developing country, that there are 1.3 billion people of China, and they are pressing ahead along the road of socialism. And
who is financing them? Why, we're financing, ladies and gentlemen, through the World Bank, through the International Monetary Fund, through the Asian Development Corporation, from the Agency for International Development, and all the other American corporations and businesses that, you know, are funding massive amounts of money in there. And your tax money is being used to guarantee the security of all of those companies' investments, and many of the massive loans that have been given to China today to build up their infrastructure. We are once again creating the best enemy money could buy, but we can't let the American people realize we're financing socialism.
You know, there was a business meeting.
Hold that off right there.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Joan Paris, and she's just been at this conference back in New York City. It's the Millennium Summit Plus 5. And while our focus was centered on what was going on in New Orleans and in Mississippi, events, world-shaking events, were taking place in New York, and most people are totally unaware of the significance of what happened there. Joan was just talking about a speech that had been given by the president of China. Now, China is one of the most repressive nations in the world today, with 1.3 billion people. And, of course, the president says, you know, we are a developing country and we're pursuing socialism. What he didn't add is, and we're being financed by the American government, because they wouldn't want the American people to realize that they were using our wealth and the wealth of our children and unborn generations to build up these brutal tyrannies throughout the world.
Well, and let's talk about the Chinese experiment. There was a vice president executive from the World Bank, Mrs. Leoti, and she was talking at a separate meeting. There are all these other forums that go on while you have all of the world leaders there. And this business convocation was corporate leaders from around the world. And she made an amazing statement that you won't see printed in the press, and I don't think there were too many of us there that were journalists. But she said, imagine to these corporate leaders, can you imagine how much money could be saved if everybody in the world had the same pay level as they do in China? And this is what's being targeted, Dr. Stan, in our country. All of the conditions are being created to destroy this nation.
And basically to transfer our wealth, our jobs, our factories to other countries and to gradually lower our living standards. But they can't let the American people know that. They have to think that, oh, this is happening because, oh, my goodness, we just don't know how it's all coming about. But it's all part of a master plan. It's to lower our living standards and impoverish our people and enslave our children.
Well, she knew she had sympathetic ears that were, you know, in agreement with her. And so how is all of this being accomplished? There is a number of organizations that have been put into place that are working to accomplish this. One of the things that you'll find that was on the agenda at the United Nations is reform of the United Nations. And by reform, they mean setting up public-private partnerships. Now, public-private partnerships were seen enacted in our local communities at the state level, at the national, and in the global bodies. And there's one group called the Government Investor Network. And the Government Investor Network, I'm just going to go through this just so our readers have an example, our listeners have an example of how these public-private partnerships work. And I think it'll be pretty obvious how they can be detrimental to our freedoms, our liberty.
Now, could you explain to our listeners what a public-private partnership is? They may be a little confused by the term.
Certainly. Public is government. Private is
private corporations,
business,
right?
Private business.
And so basically what they want to do is get them in partnership like they do in any fascist society. That's what...
Exactly.
What fascism was corporate socialism, a marriage between corporations and government. So pick up the story, Jill.
Well, this is the whole foundation. This is the bedrock, because the real purpose of world government is, again, to have absolute control over all of the world's wealth and power and resources. And so this is the vehicle to harness.
And, of course, the corporations then will rule the world right along with the bureaucrats who they control.
Exactly. And so here's an example from Nicaragua. And the benefits given for this government investor network is to enhance the capacity of government to inform and consult with the private sector. Well, I ask my American fellow citizens, how do you think about the duty of government to inform and consult with the private sector, so that they can, be enriched? So government members are supposed to provide the private sector with updates on projects and get feedback, and then the private sector goes back to the in-government, or back to the government, and tells them about any investment impediments or remedies that they want so that they can build their projects.
In other words, we have a very close working relationship between government and major corporations, but we never want the average individual to understand what's really going on, because they would realize that this is a vehicle by which they will be enslaved under the corporate fascist system that is being established.
And not just a partnership, but in fact, the capitalist will be dictating to government.
Right. And believe me, capitalism and freedom are incompatible. I believe in freedom. But of course, we're talking about fascism. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Joan Paris. And we're talking really about what she learned when she was back at the Millennium Conference. And here are all of these world leaders and the corporate leaders and the financial leaders and the government leaders all getting together, planning your future. And I dare say that most of you didn't read a word about this over the in the major media. Would that be a fair statement?
I think that would be an absolutely fair statement.
Go ahead, Jen.
In fact, it's harder and harder to get in. This time, after attending conferences for 9 years, Dr. Stan, I found that I was scrutinized, that my credentials were scrutinized. I was questioned. And I don't know how long I'll be able to go back to these things, because I just feel a real tightening down and a clamping down on information. It was more difficult for... just to gain physical entrance, the...
But you actually were accredited. You actually had your credentials as a member of the press, didn't you?
Yes, I did. But they are policing everyone. I was asked, well, who is your audience? And, who is KFER? So there was a very, very different feeling. You can feel the changes.
Well, of course, the last thing that this group, this cabal, wants is for the American people, indeed the people of the world, to realize what this is really all about. And this is basically what Edward Bellamy wrote about in 1881 in his book Looking Backward, where supposedly it was a fictional story of a man who fell asleep and woke up in the year 2000. At that point, they lived in a wonderful, idyllic society. And the great corporation ruled everything. All the corporations had eventually been consolidated into the great corporation. And it was the great corporation that, of course, worked with government to provide for the people from the cradle to the grave. And they said it was the fulfillment of that age-old poem. And then they quoted that poem that had been written so long ago, Locksley Hall, "For I dipped into the future, for as any eye could see, saw a vision of the world, and all the wonder that would be. Heard the heavens filled with shouting, and the rain to ghastly dew, of the nation's airy navies grappling in the central blue, till the war drums throbbed no longer, and the battle flags were furled, in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World." And Bellamy wrote that in the 1880s, about when the corporation would rule the world.
Oh, that's frightening. But that's so beautiful, because this is exactly what is being constructed. And that poetic picture just really, really describes what's being done.
All right, hold that thought. We're going to bring our stations right on right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Joan Paris, who has been at these conferences. She's been attending conferences for almost a decade, and she has been to many of the international conferences and the State of the World Forum meetings. 5 years ago, she was at the Millennium Conference held in New York City, and of course, she was again at the one held during this last month in September, where all the captains and the kings and the rulers of the world got together to plan your future. And if you didn't read about it in the major media, it's because you weren't supposed to.
Well, one of these side events was what we've been discussing here, and it was the launch of the Global Compact's Business Unusual, UN Unusual, facilitating UN reform through partnerships. So we're talking about public-private partnerships, and this was held over at the New York University. Some of the information I was able to get there was about government investor networks and how these public-private partnerships will work. So, Dr. Stan, when I think of the government really is simply a vehicle paid for with our tax dollars, and they provide the policing, and of course, the private is the business that reaps all of the advantages of this type of protection. This network is to enhance intra-government capacity for coordination, capacity building, and accountability. And so there you have that policing arm, accountability. The government agencies are required to coordinate, And government officials learn what the investor's issues are. In other words, their needs, their wants, the investor. And then they track the responses in order to facilitate an environment for private business to develop the projects that they want. So in Nicaragua, there was an example where they wanted to develop some type of a tourism industry, and this was solely at the investor's request. They wanted a road. And so the whole process is to improve government decision-making through laws and marketing. So laws and marketing are targeted. And eventually we want to bring this down here to the United States. So keep this in the back of your mind because this is being implemented. It has been here for years. Reducing red tape and regulations to make it easier for private businesses. Improved infrastructure, highways, telephone, environment, any environmental cleanup that's needed, the government provides in order for business to develop their project. Any improved services that are needed by business were paid for through the airports, ferries, any type of transportation. And then to implement this also requires improved security and governance. So then you have added police and policing, militarization of our police is what we see happening, and then shared information. So there has to be a mechanism that the government is used for information on financing and training and promotion in order to help the private. And then the final step is this new dynamic of coordination and openness within government and within the private sector and the cross sector. So they're all working together in order to enhance the profits of private business.
And of course, Joan is sitting here reading these various documents she got at the Millennium Conference. Here you see this public-private partnership, but at the expense of the people. And we will be paying for this as the corporations make their great profits. And then, of course, the government will ensure those profits. And, of course, certainly will do everything they possibly can to make sure that the people will be kept in line. The people are not to be allowed, of course, to rise up or do anything about it. We see our corporations moving to communist China, where there's total totalitarian control over the people. And, if you're not willing to work at, a 10-hour day for, 50 cents an hour, why, you'll just be put out on the street and you'll be blackballed. You won't be able to get another job. Total totalitarian situation being actually helped and financed by American corporations, which are subsidized by our government. Where is the outcry from the people in this country about the use of slave labor? And, of course, it's muted and it's silenced.
Well, let's make this really personal, and let's look at how this is playing out in the United States today, right now. Your listeners are very smart, Dr. Stan, and I'm sure they've already figured this out. But my husband was mentioning a news story that he saw on the Internet the other day in the Mercury News. I'll probably be in trouble for this one, just like some other things they've done in the past. But it's a great article, and it's entitled "Critics Raise the Roof on Post-Storm Federal Funding." Well, this is about something that's going on in New Orleans. And this journalist is talking about these thousands and thousands of blue tarps that are being nailed down on wind-damaged roofs.
About 300,000, my understanding. 300,000 houses need something to protect the roofs, since many of the roofs have been damaged by the storm. So what happened? How did they determine who was going to get the contract for putting the blue tarps on, 300,000 roofs?
Well, first of all, people may or may not realize that their homeowner's insurance pays for this service. So why is our government taking our tax dollars, billions of them, that we're just on a tipping point of destroying this country? So most of these people have some type of insurance, and that's already covered by the homeowner's policy.
Now, why couldn't they just get a blue tarp and put it on themselves?
Well, they could have.
And but, of course, what is it going to cost to put that tarp on these 300,000 homes?
Well, normally, the insurance company would pay about $300 a roof to cover one of those.
But, of course, the government's got lots of money. How much are they paying?
But it's not the government's money. It's our money, and it's destroyed our economy.
How much are they putting on?
How much more taxes can we...
Well, about $2,400?
Yes, it's about $2,400 a roof.
And it takes about 2 hours to do this. So the contractors, these are not little bees. These are the major corporations that are getting these massive contracts of our money. $2,400 for 2 hours work, and the government supplies the blue tarp. They don't even have to put the money out.
That's right.
For 300,000 homes.
But it's even more stupid than that. These tarps have a life of about 3 months. Are they going to get all the roofs replaced in 3 months? No, the tarps are going to rot, and then the rainy season's going to come, and we're back to square one.
Well, we'll get them on just before the they'll begin to rot just when the rainy season comes. This is what's known as government planning.
And this is what happens when government is in control. So we don't want government in control of business. We want free enterprise. We want a laissez-faire economy, because the $2,400, $2,500 they're paying to nail down this free tarp is approximately the cost of putting a new roof on a house, for heaven's sakes. And the government doesn't know how to use money wisely. It only knows how to spend money. So this is a horrible waste. And a press officer from the Army Corps of Engineers said that the agency strictly followed government contracting requirements.
In other words, that makes it perfectly all right to spend $2,400 for a two-hour job of stapling a blue tarp on the roofs of 300,000 homes. Now, is anybody out in the listening audience concerned about this? We have that article. I saw that, Joan, and I found it difficult to believe, but then I shouldn't. I mean, this is the way the government works, and when you say, this is ridiculous, they say, well, we're just following regulations.
Well, and these contractors, you asked Dr. Stan where they came from. They came from a government list of preferred contractors, and charging exorbitant rates. So it's an insider network, and then you have all of the contractors in the local area that are just, you know, sitting there wishing that they had work. This area is devastated.
They brought in a contractor from Florida who was a friend of Haley Barbour, who is the governor of Mississippi, and gave him $250 million contract to pick up trash. To bring in people to pick up limbs and trash. Now, you would think that the people in the neighborhoods could pick up the trash and the limbs and things like that. $250 million to pick up trash, you know, in the New Orleans area? Or I guess no, that would be the Mississippi area there. But, I mean, does anybody think that maybe they ought to have a bid? They might have used local people rather than bringing somebody in from Florida into Mississippi to pick up trash for $250 million. Where is the money coming from? Why, ladies and gentlemen, it's coming from you and me.
So that's the abomination of the public-private partnership, or stated in other terms, fascism.
Well, they're talking about spending $200 billion to rebuild New Orleans and certainly Louisiana and Mississippi. Now, no place in the Constitution. Is there any authorization for this sort of thing? But the current administration doesn't believe in the Constitution. They're just going to spend the money. Not only that, they are actually letting contracts to Indian corporations, corporations coming from India to the United States to do some of the major network. They want to, certainly Bechtel is getting contracts, and Fluor is getting contracts, and Halliburton, which is still paying Dick Cheney a $200,000 a year deferred salary, because of course Cheney had worked for Halliburton. So what is it now, about 5-6 years since he worked for Halliburton, but he's getting a deferred salary of $200,000 a year. Somebody might think that was a bribe, but of course it's not. It's a deferred salary, so that's perfectly all right. So Dick Cheney's getting his deferred salary from Halliburton, and Halliburton's getting all those no-bid contracts, not only in Iraq, but to help rebuild New Orleans and Mississippi. Does anybody out there think there might be conflict of interest?
It's huge. In the next hour, Dr. Stan, I'm going to pull out George Bush's speech from the United Nations so that our listeners will hear what he tells the rest of the world. And it's a little different from what we might think he supports and believes in at the United Nations. I'm a Republican. I've always been a Republican, so I'm always interested to know what my Republican president is supporting and how he wants to help implement the goals of the United Nations and how he supports the United Nations.
But he's really a globalist. That is why he refuses to close the border with Mexico. That's why he wants to make the people who are here illegally legal. I mean, they say one thing, they do another. It's so difficult for people to believe that our leaders, both Democrat and Republican, have no loyalty to the United States. That's why they actively refuse to try to close the border. That's why they refuse to have English the official language of our country. That's why they've done nothing at all to allow prayer in our schools. Because, of course, they want to destroy the Christian heritage of this nation. They know exactly what they're doing, but they can't tell the American people that. They would rise up in their righteous indignation because we are still a moral and religious people, and the majority of the people in this country adhere to one or another branch of Christendom. But our leaders, although professing to believe that way, never judge a man by what he says. Watch and see what he does. Is there allegiance to America and preservation of our Christian society? Or are they dedicated to bribing the Christian organizations through the faith-based initiative not to speak out against what's going on? In other words, whoever pays the piper calls the tune. And the Christian church has been largely bought off, or much of it, through the faith-based initiatives, and they won't speak out as we move from freedom to fascism to globalism towards the establishment of a new world order and a new world religion.
And unfortunately, most people get sidetracked by this left-right debate, Republican-Democrat. And at the top, it really doesn't matter what party. And here at the bottom, we can't let that cloud our vision either, because it really has no meaning. At the top, the elitists keep moving this agenda forward. It does not matter who is in the White House. This Global Investor Network, says that they are going to make a toolkit available to governments. And where have we heard that before? We've heard that in our local Agenda 21 and the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives has a toolkit for communities. And so the same thing, the same framework, the same format is implemented no matter what the program is. And then this network is going to integrate into donor programs, for example, business and environment and regional economic integration. And then they will make available to investment promotion agencies the same type of tools to enhance these public-private partnerships. And we need to pay attention to the word regional, because I'm currently the chairwoman of our local fire agency. So if any of you lives in the lower Santa Cruz County, there is a movement underfoot from the regional government bodies to combine the fire agencies into one group. That would destroy the agency that I'm a part of, because the agencies they want to force us into a merger with are bankrupting themselves on workers' compensation premiums because of losses. And I don't know if that's, because of morale problems or management or, a streak of bad luck or what. But nobody from the regional body ever came to me as the head of my fire agency and asked me about this. Our fire personnel are being indoctrinated and they are attempting to force a dialogue that would merge all of these. So regionalism is a part of this new form of governance where you, the individual citizen, lose authority, you lose control, you lose a voice in your local government. And so I don't care if it's something in your local community. I don't care if it's at the national level. I don't care if it's at the international level. This type of phony collectivist government is rearing its ugly head in every aspect of our lives.
And they've wanted to do away with local control under all circumstances. Everything is to be dictated from above, although many times you'll get the impression, for instance, with our local Agenda 21, that it was our idea. It's never our idea. It's always from the top down. It's all about control.
And it's always dishonest.
It's always dishonest.
It's off the record.
And they do not want the American people to learn the truth. And that's why Joan does what she does, and that's why we do what we do. And we hope many of you will want to get copies of these programs and listen to them several times to find out what Joan is talking about. And the documentation is all here. In fact, she's sitting across from me with all these things piled up in front of her. We're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up this hour. And then, of course, we'll have another hour later with our good friend Joan Paris. Well, Joan, why don't you go ahead? We've got 3 minutes here before we have to go to our break.
Well, you know, on a positive note, when I talk about regionalization of government in your local communities, there is so much that we can do. And one of them is attending your local meetings of different boards and special agencies and city councils, and as you understand the issues, speak out. I think another thing that we can do is just you know, in your spiritual life, develop that closeness and that relationship with the Lord, because in the end, this is a spiritual battle, and that will be your bedrock and your foundation. And I think the third thing is just to develop the things that you need to do to occupy this earth. I think we are commanded to occupy and be salt and light, and that means taking care of your family and helping your children in their education, teaching them right and wrong, and teaching them the truths that will sustain them as individuals. Because at the United Nations, a statement was made by Kofi Annan that in one of these documents that they were afraid that some of these countries might try to be self-sufficient, and that's the last thing they want is self-sufficiency. So
we've got one caller out here. Let's just go to Jim, and we'll cover this more a little later. Jim, did you have a quick question for Joan?
Yeah, I was hoping, Joan, that you could discuss the FTAA at some point.
All right, well, maybe we can do that next hour, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye, Jim. Okay, fine, and that's the free trade zone of the Americas, and perhaps we can touch on that, because it is part of this overall globalist program. But Joan was just saying that Kofi Annan, who is the Secretary General of the United Nations, expressed a concern that some countries might want to go on their own. You have to understand that we are going to have a world government. Everybody has to be included, and any country that wants to go on their own, they will destroy.
Absolutely destructive.
And, of course, always in the name of peace. They always fight wars in the name of peace. As I said earlier, every war of the last century was fomented and actually created and financed, usually on both sides, by these very people who keep talking about what a wonderful time it will be, when the world will be as one, and we will all live together happily under the new coming world government. And until you understand that these people are really wicked, that they have a different sense of morality, they see nothing wrong with wars or mass genocide as long as it moves us away from freedom towards this one world dream that they have embraced. For you see, these people march to a different drumbeat. They dream a different dream. They worship a different God. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours every day by radio, and 5 hours every day on the Internet, and 4 hours every day on satellite and 4 hours every day on shortwave, trying to educate people about this very substance we're talking about tonight. This subject involves the move towards a new world order and a new world religion. And many, many people, of course, will pretend that they oppose that, that they're great patriots, that they love America, but you never believe what a person says. You watch what they do. And if they can justify the unbridled immigration into this country of people coming in illegally, if they are intent upon destroying the culture of this country, if they are intent upon destroying the lives and minds of our children, and there's so many things that are being done now to undermine the health of our people, whether it be water fluoridation. And if you think that sounds ridiculous, you should certainly get our material on water fluoridation. Or putting a highly toxic, neurotoxic substance into our vaccines, mercury. Or putting this substance into the mouths of people, knowing full well that it will increase the incidence of Alzheimer's disease. Adding to our food MSG, which of course is monosodium glutamate. The glutamate is toxic to the brain, as is aspartame. These are excitotoxins. They know exactly what NutraSweet does. They just don't want the American people to know. In fact, right now in New Mexico, there's an effort to outlaw this, and not a word of this is getting out across America. Just last month, the scientists, about 500 to 700 scientists who work for the EPA, put out a press release saying, we've got to stop water fluoridation, we're poisoning the people. Did you read about it in your newspaper? And of course you're not going to read about it, because of the degree of control that today exists over the media, and ultimately then of what the American people think. Well, that's what Radio Liberty is all about, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we try gradually to expand our outreach and reach more people and bring them to an understanding of the fact we're fighting a spiritual battle on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Now, I do need to remind our listeners that we are having a conference here in the Monterey Bay area, and it's going to be on the 19th of November, and we do hope that many of you can come. We're going to be having lunch, so you're going to have a reservation. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, if you can make it. And then, of course, please go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Listen to our programs on the Internet 5 hours a day, directly or indirectly, and then listen to our archive programs, and you can hear this program archived there. We'll be up there for 6 weeks. And then we ask you, of course, to pull down our newsletters and read them and study them and copy them and distribute them. And you see, I can only reach so many people working 5 hours a day, but you can reach people every hour of the day. So encourage people to listen to our programs, to challenge what we say, to determine if it be possible that what we are saying is true and what you're reading in the newspaper is false. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, let me just repeat that poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson. For I dipped into the future, far as any eye could see, saw a vision of the world and all the wonders that would be, heard the heavens filled with shouting and the rain the ghastly dew of the nation's airy navies grappling in the central blue, till the war drums throbbed no longer and the battle flags were furled in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. And that is what this is really all about. I mean, you'll find this in Masonic writings, in Edward Bellamy's writings, writings of Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. We find it referred to by Andrew Carnegie in his book, Triumphant Democracy. They all understand what it's about, but you are not to know. It's about a new world order and a new world religion and the loss of freedom. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from ordinarily from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we specifically ask that you do not call in for the time being because we have with us in studio a very, very special guest and good friend, Joan Paris. And Joan has for many years been attending international monetary meetings and meetings of the State of the World Forum, and she was at the conference in the year 2000 in New York, the Millennium Conference, and it came back, and we put together a Millennium Summit based upon what we learned there and the plans for establishing the world government. And then, of course, we put together a 4-tape set and a video on the Millennium Conference. Well, now 5 years have passed, and Joan had attended the Millennium Summit Plus 5 conference in New York. Now, Bill Clinton had a separate conference there where he brought in leaders from all over the world. I mean, great intellects like Barbara Streisand and Leonardo DiCaprio and other simpler great people of great stature. But he also had Rupert Murdoch and George Soros and many of the King of Jordan and many of the world leaders were there. Bill Clinton's Earth Summit or convention, which was sort of ran simultaneously with the one that Joan attended, but all the leaders of the world were at this conference in New York City just last month, where momentous decisions were made on your future and mine. And the fact you did not hear much about this simply is a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. And with that, Joan, pick up the story.
Well, Dr. Stan, at the last hour, we were talking about Kofi Annan and being afraid that individual states would resort to self-help. And this was a speech that he gave to the World Summit in New York on September 14th of 2005. And he said exactly, the clear danger was that states of all kinds might increasingly resort to self-help. So that is a striking contrast to self-help, individualism, the rugged individualism that we've come to know and love in the United States, and collectivism, the oppressive, brutal, collectivist regimes and dictatorships that have been planted and nurtured all around the world for decades. That's what we're contrasting this to, and this is the goal of the United Nations and its Secretary General, to prevent you or any nation from resorting to self-help.
And if there's any nation that wants to go its own way, doesn't want to become part of this one-world tyranny that is being imposed, will be destroyed. And they will assassinate its leaders, I believe, or they will bring economic chaos to the nation by withdrawing financial help or calling in loans or perhaps simply by getting involved in a war. And believe me, they can do all of those things. And if you doubt that at all, we have a wonderful book written by a man who is part and parcel of this whole movement. It's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. We have four interviews with a gentleman that was part of what he called a corporatocracy involving the World Bank, the intelligence agencies, the leaders of the governments of the world, and, of course, the great corporations. Confessions of an Economic Hitman, or the four-tape set, The Economic Hitman. Here's an insider telling you what's really going on. You're not going to hear that elsewhere. So we're going to be back in just a moment with Joan Vian as we begin analyzing what's going on. But remember the one thing they fear. There may be nations out there that don't want to go along with this, that really want to be independent. They don't want to become part of the New World Order and the New World Religion.
This is Joan Paros, and I was at the Millennium Summit, the 5-year follow-up with my good friend Joan Vian. But sometimes we can sound alike. Joan's a lot more dynamic than I am.
No. You're both very dynamic.
You know, when we talk about ways of keeping governments compliant and in line, I had the unique opportunity of meeting one of the architects of an organization called the Financial Action Task Force. And in a press briefing, what was his name? Somebody, Maria, from Italy. And if you spend any time studying the Patriot Act, you'll find that the United States is a member of the Financial Action Task Force. And researching this on the internet, I found that there are, just a handful of countries out there that are not compliant with the financial rules. The Financial Action Task Force is tied to the central banks. It comes down from the BIS in Switzerland, and it dictates...
BIS is the Bureau...
Bank for International Settlements.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, right. That's the central bank or central bank.
Exactly. And it dictates what our banking laws will be. So there is this framework, and there is very strict direction and regulation that is provided by which all countries and all businesses must comply in order to play in this game.
But, of course, everybody thinks that we have elected representatives. Our elected representatives in the House of Representatives and the Senate are simply figureheads for this true power elite that rules the world. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, they're very pathetic, Dr. Stan, because they normally don't even read the legislation, much less understand what's in it or how it is subverting and subjecting us to this global world order. What I have that we'll touch on is I have President Bush's speech to the United Nations, and as a figurehead, he was one of the first that was brought to speak. I have some notes from a press conference with Tony Blair and Obasanjo, the president of Nigeria, and this musician, Bob Geldof. And
a musician, they brought in a very learned musician to lecture you on about the world government.
Well, what was really pathetic about this press briefing, Dr. Stan, is that the elite media of the world all directed their questions to not Tony Blair, who very obviously speaks eloquently of the world agenda, but to Bob Geldof, and he just looked like a burnout musician.
Studio is Joan Paris. She's talking about the Millennium Summit that she attended this last month. And of course, there they have Tony Blair and they have the President of the United States, George Bush, and then they have a musician. What was this a musician?
Bob Geldof. And
Bob Geldof. And Joan was just saying he looks like a burnout, hippie, I guess, from the past. And of course, but at the conference, they're directing many of the questions.
Dr. Stan, every question from the media was directed to this stringy-haired, rather inarticulate person when Tony Blair was sitting right next to him. And I think Tony Blair finally got a little frustrated with it. And the last question that was allowed to be asked was from my friend, Joan Vian. And it gave Tony his opportunity to... pontificate for about 15 minutes because it was the only opportunity he had to speak. The other thing that I would like to go over, and I think I'll do this first, is there were just a few of us who went to the press room on September 14th at 10:30 in the morning, and there was a gentleman there who was Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. He was obviously trained in the law. His name was Rob Orr. And oddly enough, this press briefing was not recorded in any way. Normally, we can go to the tape or the video room, and if you're a video journalist, But I thought it was so interesting that they did not record him, because these rooms are very secure and everything is recorded, and this was not. This man writes the documents for the United Nations, and so it was very interesting to hear him speak. And what he provided to the few of us that showed up for this briefing was just a thumbnail sketch of what the outcome documents would achieve. And so just really briefly, the highlights that this man that writes the documents told us is that the document emphasizes development, that there will be an additional $50 billion a year for fighting poverty by 2010. It highlights a commitment by the developing countries to adopt national plans for achieving the Millennium Development Goals by 2010. There's a big concern at the United Nations that so many of these developing countries, and there are many of them, are not coming into compliance, and they're not even beginning to start to achieve the goals that are set out. There was a very strong message to the WTO, or at the WTO, in that development must remain at the center of the Doha round of trade negotiations. And this speaks to Jim's question about the FTAA. So trade, free trade of the Americas, any of the trading things are spoken to very strongly in the final outcome document that came out of this 60th summit of the United Nations. There is a very strong emphasis on terrorism in the final outcome document. This was the first clear and unqualified United Nations condemnation of terrorism in all its forms and manifestations, committed by whomever, wherever, and for whatever purposes. My question to this Assistant Secretary General was what type of a definition they would write, because I'm familiar with a definition of terrorism that we find in the Patriot Act.
That has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism, of course.
Oh, no, of course not. But if you are opposed to this globalist agenda, or if you in any way say or do anything that would subvert it, then by definition you could become a terrorist.
And I think that's such an important thing for our listeners to understand. If you read the Patriot Act, which came out immediately after the 9/11 attack, this is how we're going to compete, going to oppose terrorism. Not one word about Islamic terrorism. The definition of terrorism is anybody opposed to what the government is doing or wants to change our form of government. And then that would then carry over to the internationalist view. Anybody who opposes the move towards world government is a terrorist. And of course, if you're a terrorist, why, you will lose your rights, you'll lose your property, you may well lose your freedom and your life. People say this could never happen. You must understand, we are dealing with people who have a different world view. These people hate God. These people want to bring about a world government, and they do not worry about ideas of rights or freedom or liberty or truth. They have an agenda. They have killed literally millions and millions of people in pursuit of this goal by fomenting the First World War and the Second World War and the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the Gulf War and all sorts of wars in Africa and massacres throughout the world. Certainly the loss of a few more lives are not going to stand in their way. And as H.G. Wells has written in his book, you know, The New World Order, millions are going to die fighting the New World Order.
So don't oppose it. And I'm saying that tongue in cheek. We have to oppose it. We have to now. We have to become informed of the forms that it's taking. And aside from this summation by this Assistant Secretary General, very strong message that came out is that everything is being pushed down to the local level. And we were told at the conference that in order to get ownership of this agenda, it must be implemented at the local level. And that's why when you pick up your Santa Cruz Local Agenda 21, or you look at your Action Pajaro Valley, and the plans at the local levels, they dovetail with these with this agenda, the development agenda, embodied in what's called sustainable development, and that is the foundation that all of this rests upon.
And there is a document where this whole diabolical plan is laid out. It's called the Global Biodiversity Assessment. It's 1,142 pages. You can get it at your local bookstore. It's published by Cambridge University Press. The way to implement it is called Agenda 21. It's the agenda for the 21st century for implementing sustainable development. And Joan was kind enough to bring me a copy of the United Nations one, but we offer here one of the local Agenda 21, which was put together by people in Santa Cruz, supposedly expressing the views of the local people here, but it really didn't.
It's a joke. There's a template in Agenda 21, and there's a certain conformity that has to be followed.
And so when in Santa Cruz, where I live, they came up with Agenda 21 just by chance, just by happenstance, one chance in a million. It was exactly the same thing that had been put together by the United Nations and is being implemented all throughout the world. It is a conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen. And the one thing is, they cannot let the people understand that, of course, we're moving from freedom to fascism.
Two things, Dr. Stan. When you say conspiracy, in the last hour we were talking about the global investment network, and that's a hard word to take, and it's thrown at us who do this research, but I have a UN document in my hand from the Business Forum, and it says that off the record forum of 180 experts from private and public sectors, this is part of the magic of their formula, is doing things off the record. I have it in writing, because that way, ladies and gentlemen, you don't know what's being planned, and when it rears its ugly head, you don't know what it is, you don't know where it came from, and you are put at a disadvantage to even deal with it. So they actually advocate in their own forums openly to do this off the record, to do it secretly, to do it in the dark.
Chris, the one thing is they fear is the people of the world are going to find out what they're doing. Because they're not that many of them. It's just that they have great wealth and great power, and they control the media, and they control the government, and they control the military, and they control many of the religious leaders. But they are certainly a very small minority. These are the captains of the kings of the world, moving us towards this one-world dictatorship under their control in the name of helping the common man.
That's true. And the other point, thank you for bringing up the Global Biodiversity Report, Dr. Stan, because if your listener goes to, I think it's about page 980, if you go to the back of that 1,100 and how many pages document?
142 pages.
You will find where the Islamic, the Christian, and the Jewish tradition are blamed for all of the problems in the world. And in fact, if you raise your child, for example, as a Christian, this is considered to be a form of mental illness. And of course, there are all kinds of programs being brought about to deal with that. So anyway, I wanted to anchor that in a document so that I don't want to sound like I'm making any of this up. Getting back to the Assistant Secretary's summation of the important outcomes of the document from this UN summit on terrorism, there's three points that he made about terrorism. The first one we talked about is United Nations condemnation of terrorism. Second was a strong political push for a comprehensive convention this year on terrorism, and the support for a nuclear terrorism convention. And the third item was to support strategy to fight terrorism in ways that make the international community stronger and terrorists weaker. And that would be your global police state. That would be your United Nations Army, which is addressed later in his outline. There's a responsibility to protect section, and it's unambiguous acceptance of all United Nations members of collective international responsibility to protect populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity.
Like they did
so
in Rwanda
on.
And
Darfur,
right.
And on, and Bosnia.
And as they're doing today, and of course in Zambia. By me in Zaire, where about 3 million people have been killed. And isn't it amazing? We never talk about the ongoing war in Zaire, where 3 million people have been killed. I wonder why.
So the key is that there will be collective military action taken when national authorities don't do it or when other means prove inadequate. And here you have the god of collectivism, which is the ultimate tyranny. In the section under peace building and peacekeeping, and whenever I see the word peace in a UN document, I always substitute it with war. The document called for the creation of a peace building commission with a full support office and funding, and also a new standing police capacity for UN peacekeeping operations. So very clearly, that's a standing UN army, and this has been in the making for quite a while, and it has to be enacted first at the local and the national levels, and we go all the way back to the Brahimi Report, we go all the way back to the commission that created the Department of Homeland Security, because that complied with what was dictated by the Brahimi Report that we saw in the original Millennium Summit in 2000 that called for a central organizing point for all of the emergency personnel in a nation.
And if anybody's interested in the Brahimi Report, that is contained with our Millennium Summit syllabus we put together in 2000. Brahimi was the foreign minister of Algeria, and he put together a report calling for this world police force and world army to control the people of the world. It's all laid out. You can read it, but of course, how many people have ever heard of Brahimi? How many people really understand that the Office of Homeland Security was created to go along with this whole idea, that they have created this whole world terrorist movement? Who's funding world terrorism? Why, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Who's funding Saudi Arabia and Pakistan? Well, you are, ladies and gentlemen. We're keeping the corrupt Saudi government in power, and we're giving billions of dollars to the Pakistans who are training the terrorists who are bringing about this whole world terrorist movement. Once again, we have created the best enemy money could buy. And now, of course, the United Nations is putting together all sorts of committees and organizations in this battle against terrorism.
Well, and the other main point has to do with what's called human rights and democracy. Not a republic, but a democracy. And the intention of this document is to reaffirm democracy as a universal value and welcome a new democracy fund.
Now, remember that we fought the First World War to make the world safer democracy when the Founding Fathers of America didn't want a democracy. The Founding Fathers of America said the last thing we want is a democracy, for as James Madison had written in the 10th of the Federalist Papers, democracies are air spectacles of turbulence and contention, are air incompatible with the rights of personal liberty and private property, and are usually as violent in their lives as they are usually short in their duration as they are violent in their death. They did not want a democracy because they knew they always ended up in dictatorship. Plato wrote that in the Republic almost 2,400 years ago. But today they keep saying we want democracy. Why would they want a democracy when, as Plato said, democracies always end up in despotism? Could it be that's what they really want to bring about here in the United States? We're going to be back in just a moment with our guest, Joan Paris, as we bring our other stations back on board. And she continues her discussion of the Millennium Summit held in September, which most people never heard about. Well, our guest is Joan Paris, and she's simply talking about this this move towards world democracy, and this is what they're pushing. They're also talking about how we've got to fight terrorism. But as I simply pointed out, I mean, who is it who is funding the world terrorist movement? Saudi Arabia. That was brought out by the initial Senate Intelligence Committee. Well, of course, you never read that because the Bush administration actually censored 28 pages of that dealing with how the Saudi Arabians were funding the world terrorist movement. The other country that's funding the world terrorism is Pakistan. They have their terrorist training camps there. And who's funding Pakistan? Why, you are, ladies and gentlemen. That's where your tax money is going. We've sent them billions of dollars, and they're training the terrorists, but they claim that one of these days they're going to stop doing it. We have created the best enemy money could buy, and we're going to have to give up our freedom fighting terrorism. which is being funded by our good friends in Saudi Arabia and our good friends in Pakistan. Go ahead, Joan.
And as a trade-off for giving up that freedom, we're going to have what's called a more secure world, our shared responsibility. That's the title of the report that Kofi Annan prepared for this Millennium Summit Conference, the five-year follow-up. The last one, we had the Brahimi Report, and this document is the more secure world. And one of the people who was on the commission that put this together was Brent Scowcroft.
He was in the first Bush administration. I forgot whether he was Secretary of State or whether he was at President's advisor, but he was very close to George Herbert Walker Bush.
Exactly. His biography is very interesting. And, you know, we're talking about nation building and this global army. He was the national security advisor to Ford and Bush starting in 82, and then he was a vice chairman of Kissinger and Associates. And in that capacity, he advised and assisted a whole lot of United States and foreign corporate leaders on global joint venture opportunities. There you go, public-private partnerships. He is the perfect man at this time of nation building. I take a couple of publications. I don't ever get time to read them, but I picked up my copy of the National Interest, the fall issue, 2005, and I noticed on the cover, there's an article entitled In the Wake of War by Brent Scowcroft and Samuel R. Berger. And I just scanned a little bit of it, but this should be instructive as we talk about nation building. The byline of this article says America shouldn't forget that the other half of regime change is building a new regime. And so Scowcroft, who is so well trained for this, says that we need to get serious about nation building, and this dovetails with the United Nations report for the Millennium Summit.
I think that's so interesting that Scowcroft would be writing this with Sandy Berger. Of course, Scowcroft was the Republican National Security Advisor. Sandy Berger was the Democrat National Security Advisor, who, of course, went in the archives and stole a lot of documents dealing with, of course, the origin of the terrorist report. He was stuffing them into his stockings. He was stuffing them into his trousers. He destroyed them all just by accident, and he got off with a $50,000 fine. They had to destroy these documents. They could not let the American people know what was in those documents, because I feel that they showed that we knew exactly what was going to happen on 9/11, but we needed an incident to get us into war, to change the outlook of the American people. Why would Sandy Berger go in and steal the archives, the secret government documents, and stuff them in his stockings, stuff them into his trousers, stuff them into his pockets? How many of them did he destroy? Nobody knows. Nobody's asked what they were on them. But here is Sandy Berger, former National Security Advisor to the Democratic President, writing a book with Brent Scowcroft, former National Security Advisor to the Republican Presidents, or maybe it doesn't make a dime's worth of difference.
Good point. Couple of highlights from their article that are instructive is that it's a national security, they say, to rebuild these nations emerging from conflict. And, of course, here we are in Iraq, and who knows where we'll be next. He said that the challenges of failed states and nations emerging from conflict will remain a significant feature in the international landscape for the foreseeable future. Ladies and gentlemen, our troops, our kids, our husbands, our brothers, our sisters, our daughters are not coming home anytime soon, because when and if they are ever through in Iraq, this whole area of unstable conflict is going to continue, and we just have it confirmed here by the words of Sandy Berger and Brent Scowcroft.
And I think it's so important to understand we're doing everything we can to destabilize Iraq. We destroyed their army. We disbanded their police force. We disbanded their civil service. And then we wondered why there was chaos. And every time they try to get it rebuilt, why we destroy it again. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and Joan was just commenting that Brett Scowcroft had worked for Kissinger and Associates. Now, there was another man who worked for Kissinger and Associates. His name was Paul Bremer, and he was the first dictator administrator of Iraq once the Americans had taken Baghdad. And, of course, when the army moved in, they began working with the Iraqi army to restore order, and the Iraqi police force to restore order, and the Iraqi civil service to restore order and establish a stable government so we could take our troops out. And Paul Bremer, who used to work for Kissinger and Associates, what does he do? He goes against the advice of the American lieutenant general there, and he disbands the Iraqi army. Who's going to maintain law and order? He disbands the Iraqi police force. Who's going to maintain law and order? He disbands the civil service. Who's going to make the electricity run and the water available and the sewer available? And you know what happened? There was chaos. Well, since you got chaos, we're going to have to stay. Now, we've created a situation that is breaking out into civil war between the Sunnis and the Shias. As long as you have violence, we can justify staying there. And you must understand that nothing happens by accident. Mr. Bremer is not a stupid man at all. He used to work for Kissinger Associates. You've got to be very smart to work for Kissinger and Associates. And their purpose has been to create chaos. And then, of course, when it all comes about, they say, oh, shucks, how did that happen? Well, gee, we're just going to have to keep our people there indefinitely. Recently, of course, there was a question is, what about the Iraqi army? We've trained 100 battalions. How many of them are ready to take to the field? Well, maybe one of them. We've trained 100, and there's one that we could count on. They had a very effective army before. What happened to it? Why, Paul Bremer, eliminated the Iraqi army, disbanded the Iraqi army. Why would he have done something like that over the objection of the American military officials? Why? He's either incredibly stupid or they've intentionally created chaos. You'll have to decide which.
Well, Dr. Stan, Mr. Scowcroft and Mr. Berger validate what you've just said in the next paragraph because, you see, they're there to build public-private partnerships to manage and control all of the natural resources of the world. And we know that the main resource that's there is oil. Scowcroft and Berger say that the stark reality is that the United States today does not possess the right mix of skills and capabilities to stabilize and rebuild nations after they tore down all of the institutions that you just described. They are berating the United States.
Hold that thought right for just a moment, please, and we'll be... Well, Joan is simply discussing an article in a magazine called The National Interest, where Sandy Berger, the so-called National Security Advisor for the Democratic administration of President Clinton, is writing an article along with his counterpart, Brett Scowcroft, who was the National Security Advisor for President Ford and for President George Herbert Walker Bush. So you have a continuity of the National Security Advisors. It doesn't matter whether the Democrats or Republicans are in power. It always continues the same. There's a wonderful book out there by David Rothkopf. David Rothkopf called Running the World. It's the story of the National Security Advisors. And 19 of the last 20 of all have been tied to a man named Henry Kissinger.
Amazing. So because they say that the United States doesn't possess the skills and capabilities to stabilize and rebuild nations, therefore traditional economic development assistance, which is traditionally a civilian responsibility, is what needs to be called into play. In other words, the public-private partnership. So the public, the American government, funded by you, the taxpayer, was sent in to destabilize and change the regime. And now they're calling for the traditional civilian responsibility, or this is the private part of it. This is where you bring in Halliburton and give them billions of dollars. This is where you bring in the
Bechtel and Fluor and all of these, Monsanto. Now they've got part of the constitution of Iraq is that they will have to use Monsanto farm products and Monsanto types of seeds and genetically modified seeds. What does that have to do with anything? It has to do with we have control the future of Iraq, and we're going to force our ways upon them, whether they want them or not. And we're going to force our seeds upon them, and we're going to control their oil, and we're going to control who is, gets into positions of power, and they're going to control their military and their police force, all in the name of bringing them freedom.
And that is a public-private partnership. So they're calling for new policies that will delineate the role of the military and the civilian agencies. They say those have yet to be articulated. The absence of explicit policy and institutional frameworks in this area reflects an outdated attitude that stabilization operations are extraordinary rather than expected. And then they refer to the 1997 Clinton administration when they attempted to address this issue in PDD, Presidential Decision Directive 56. And the authors say that that worked well in helping to establish a framework for civilian-military coordination. However, it wasn't consistently implemented. So I'd like to point out that here in the early 90s, and this all goes back decades, all of this policy that's being formulated, this goes back a long time. This didn't just come out in this Millennium Summit. It's in the framework documents that have been formulating for years and years now. And then when the Bush administration took office, Bush created the Office of Stabilization and Reconstruction in the State Department in July of 2004. And this administration currently has a plan to establish a Stabilization and Reconstruction Policy Coordination Committee. And the authors say that this is a welcome first step in tightening coordination. Well, we must not be at the end of the plan there in Iraq if we need a Stabilization and Reconstruction Policy Coordination Committee. This is a very permanent office that will be funded and give direction to future operations that we're going to see happening in this very unstable area of the world.
And I think it's important for our listeners to realize that they have no intention of bringing the majority of our troops home. We're building 14 major military bases in Iraq for permanently stationing our troops. We're building the largest embassy, American embassy, anywhere in the world in Iraq. Do you really think we're planning on bringing our troops home? Do you really think we're planning on bringing our troops home from Germany? They're still there, 60 years after the Second World War. Do you really think we won the war with Japan and we brought our troops home? We're still occupying Japan. 60 years later, we're still occupying Korea 50 years after the war. We have no intention of pulling our troops out any more than we have any intention of pulling our troops out of Bosnia or out of Yugoslavia. In fact, I'll never forget when we sent our troops into Bosnia, Bill Clinton, that paragon of virtue, said, our troops will be home by November. And he wasn't lying, he just didn't say which November. They're still there, many Novembers later. But that's how the world runs. Most people have forgotten what he said. Well, he just didn't know what he was saying. Of course he knew what he was saying. He knows that we're going to keep occupying these countries. We have American troops in 130 nations throughout the world. I believe in America. I believe in freedom, but you cannot have a free society when you have a small group of people who've gained control of the reins of our government, who have a different agenda, who worship a different God. And this is what it's about. They're bringing about the one world government of the Antichrist. And it's about time the American people understand that there really are evil and wicked people in Washington, D.C.
And, you know, there's a dynamic that's going on that your listeners may not have heard of, and it's called creative destruction. One of the magazines I picked up or booklets, there's always lots of material available at these conferences.
Creative destruction, that's fascinating. What is creative destruction?
Well, the World Bank Institute has an article in their magazine called Development Outreach. Creative destruction is the thesis that you have to destroy something in order to rebuild it. And it comes out of that, in my mind, that ancient mantra, Ordo ab Chaos.
So like Orleans, New Orleans, then we're going to destroy it and then we're going to rebuild it.
Exactly. And
or Iraq, or certainly we destroyed Bosnia, we're going to rebuild that. And we destroyed Yugoslavia, we're rebuilding that. And besides that, it's great for the companies that get the contracts like Halliburton and Bechtel and Fluor.
And since we're creating public-private partnerships and the pigs at the trough are these corrupt corporations driving this, then certainly this concept of creative destruction certainly plays right into the hands of taking all of the wealth of the masses. Oh, what is that scripture where the king says, "My hands have found the eggs in the nest like a thief, and has stolen all of the eggs, and no one opened their mouth without even a peep." So we do have to speak out. The person that developed this thesis of creative destruction was named Joseph Schumpeter, S-C-H-U-M-P-E-T-E-R. The article was written by Stefano Scarpetta. But something to think about, it's a paradigm that's used and talked about. And so it's no secret if you get your hands on the right information.
Creative destruction. Could you think of a better description of what we're doing over there in Iraq? Creative destruction? After all, we're rebuilding a new society for them, whether they want it or not.
Exactly.
And I believe the next countries on the list will be Syria and Iran. And there is no question that we are planning an attack on Iran. Doesn't matter that they're no threat to the United States. Doesn't matter that that we brought the Ayatollahs to power there back in 1979 when we toppled the Shah of Iran and brought the Ayatollah Khomeini to power. People have forgotten what happened in 1979. But, of course, if you go back and you study the history of that time, you realize we did everything we could to undermine the Shah. And in 1979, I didn't understand. I said, why would we be undermining an ally, I mean, with the sixth largest army in the world, who was the bulwark against communist aggression in the Middle East? Why would we be destroying the Shah of Iran and bringing the Ayatollah Khomeini to power? In 1979, I didn't understand why Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the National Security Advisor at that time, had engineered that coup. Today I understand. We've created one of the finest enemies American diplomacy could have formed, and now we can have a justification for another great war.
And our listeners might like to hear a little bit of what George Bush had to tell the assembled dignitaries of the entire world on September the 14th.
Please, I'm waiting to hear it.
He said that, he's talking about their response to the tsunami. He says, "It's shown once again that the world is more compassionate and hopeful when we work together." So he's eschewing this principle of collectivism. He says this truth was the inspiration for the United Nations. He also said that we remain committed to those noble ideals, and going back to the preamble of the United Nations Charter, to save generations from the scourge of war and to promote social progress and life and larger freedom.
And for since then, we've had, about three or four wars that America has been involved in. Four wars the American has been involved in since the end of the Second World War, and hundreds of other wars throughout the world, all under the watch of the United Nations.
Empty platitudes. And he says that the United Nations is... well, not just that he supports all of the principles of the United Nations, but he said that we, referring to the United States, we are committed to the Millennium Development Goals.
But wait a minute, that means destruction of American sovereignty. How can the President of the United States be dedicated to the Millennium Goals when they mean the end of American sovereignty?
Because our President is not representing the average American individual. He is representing an elitist regime that functions at this body of the United Nations.
But of course, it's both Democrat and Republican regimes. There really isn't much difference between them as far as their globalist dedication, is there?
There's really no difference, because, you know, there are all these little issues that are thrown out to us to divide us, to get us to argue with one another, simply to keep us apart and to keep us off focus and off balance. And really, it's this globalist agenda that we need to have our eyes on and to understand. The average American does not want a collectivist world body with a world army that is just saying that they're going to take care of our every need. In Santa Cruz County and other places, there are the misinformed, the uninformed, and the woefully misguided who buy into this agenda. But there really are far fewer of them than there are of us, and that's why it's so important for us to understand this collective of world government that's being assembled and put together, and so that we can fight it. We have to, because if we don't, these others are committed to this. It's a fervor for them. It's like a religion, and they will impose their will on us if we don't put a stop to it.
Their tyranny on us is what it's really about.
Yes.
And they put no value on human life. They don't care how many people are slaughtered or killed or tortured or die, or how many children will die needlessly, or how many children will be damaged and destroyed by the various programs we have throughout the world. They have a much higher calling because they worship a different God.
Exactly. So basically, that's what George Bush had to tell the world body, how the United States was going to find a sure path, or help to implement this sure path to greater wealth. And he said that we need to reduce trade barriers and subsidies that are holding back developing countries. So he says, I agree with the Secretary General. The Doha Round is the most promising way to achieve these goals. And so Bush says that he's going to work to tear down any type of barriers or subsidies to our farmers. He says the United States is ready to eliminate all tariffs, subsidies, and other barriers to free flow of goods and services, as other nations do the same.
Now, but of course, what he's really saying is that our workers will then be brought down to the same level as the Chinese workers. Our workers will compete directly with the Chinese workers, and we will have equality of income throughout the world, because that's what happens when you tear down the tariffs and when you eliminate the subsidies. I don't like government subsidies, but I don't want to see the farming industry of the United States destroyed, and that's just what's going to happen. Can you imagine farmers in the United States competing with farmers in China who can produce crops at a quarter of the cost here? What do you think is going to happen to the price of wheat and the price of corn and the price of soybeans when we do away with both subsidies and tariffs? What do you think is going to happen to the price of apples, which is already falling, because most of our apples, or so many of them, are now coming in from communist China? What do you think is going to happen to the salaries of our workers, who are competing with products that are pushed in China by people working 50 cents an hour? I think President Bush knows exactly what he's talking about. He's talking about redistribution of wealth between nations, which is point 10 of the Earth Charter. Redistribution of wealth between nations, which is point 10 of the Earth Charter. If you need a copy of that, we'll be glad to send you one. It was written by that great American patriot, Mikhail Gorbachev, Maurice Strong, and of course, Stephen Rockefeller, the leader of the Rockefeller clan. When David Rockefeller dies, they have an agenda, and they're going to impoverish the American people. And if you don't understand that, and if you're not willing to get involved with us and help us to get the word out, then, of course, America, as we've known it, will be lost. And freedom, as we've known it, will simply become a remembrance of things past.
At the meeting for the Global Compact, when I was in New York, of course, this representative of the World Bank said, won't it be wonderful? Wouldn't it be wonderful? And think about how much money we could save if wages around the world matched those of the Chinese worker. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the object, just as you've said.
And you don't see that they're breaking the backs of the unions here in this country. Why? Because the leaders of the unions are part and parcel of this whole movement. And, of course, they're going to destroy the unions, they're going to just impoverish our workers, and they'll be struggling to work for the salaries comparable to that of the Chinese people working in China today. Oh, we may be talking a decade and a half from now, but they know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people. I think that's a wonderful quotation, Joe.
Yes. And George Bush closed his speech by saying that in each era of history, the human spirit has been challenged by the forces of darkness and chaos. So nice of him to admit that. He concludes by saying, and when we do, talking about, you know, responding, he said, we will help fulfill the promise of the United Nations. And so that's what President Bush had to say for you, the American people, to the assembled dignitaries of the United Nations.
And the purpose of the United Nations is a world government.
Oh, yes, of course.
And the destruction of Christianity. And when you understand that, you understand the significance of what the president said.
And we've been in world government for a long time, and so now it's a matter of implementing the global taxes, and one was agreed to on airline tickets. There will be others that are being considered, according to the Prime Minister of France.
We'll left off right there. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, Joan Paris. Joan, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, you know, I have some notes that I transcribed of Tony Blair, and if any of the listeners would like to get those, they can simply email me at joanparos@hotmail.com, and it's Joan, J-O-A-N, Paros, P as in Peter, E-R-O-S, @hotmail.com, and I'd be happy to send you that. And any inspiration that I can give you for what I have found for economic help in the times to come, ways to strengthen your family, I would just like to pass on that information to you. So go ahead and contact me at joanparos@hotmail.com, and I'd be happy to share this press briefing with Tony Blair.
All right, fine. Well, I think that I get the Joan's material. It's good. She's been there. She goes at these meetings at her own expense, and she goes because she wants to be able to let you know what's going on. So, see, certainly we appreciate what she does, and I hope you do as well. Well, you know, we've got about 2 minutes to wrap up the program. Your final thought on this? You know, it seems that we're moving rapidly towards the fulfillment of this ancient dream of the ancient mystery religions and the occult society of creating a one world government, because there truly is a spiritual component to this, isn't there?
Well, yes, there is. And the draft, and in fact, it's not the draft, but it was the final outcome document of the Millennium Conference in point four, when it talks about the values and principles. Talks about reaffirming the fundamental values, one of them being respect for nature. And, of course, that is core, is bringing in this worship of nature, because, as we said at the beginning of the first hour, everything that you find the United Nations doing is an abomination or an inversion of God's laws and God's purposes. That's why our work is so important. We should not give up hope. We should not give up courage. But there is honor and there's glory in our work. We were made to work, and we have to continue to occupy. And when we do that, you know, we are stronger, and we're fulfilling the divine aspect, or the, you know, the divine laws that God asked us to live by. And in doing that, we can do so much, really, to thwart this.
And if we put our hands in our pockets, then, of course, we immobilize God's hands. God works through people. Certainly we have to be true to Him, but understanding we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. We'll be back in just a moment. Joan Paris, thank you so much for being with us.
God bless you. Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us. As we reach out 5 hours every day by radio, by shortwave, by satellite, and certainly trying to reach people with the truth about what's really going on, the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And so we would ask you, you know, if you believe in what we're doing, to give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family. Supporters and helpers, we're on about 60 stations across America, but we could only do this with your help. It's an expensive proposition, and quite frankly, we could use your support, and certainly we ask for your prayers. Now, we invite you to go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com, where you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day directly or indirectly on the Internet. And, of course, you can pull down our archive programs. You can spend about 10 hours a day just listening to our programs. You won't get much accomplished, but you'll get an understanding of the true nature of the battle we're engaged in, which is not political, and it's not cultural, and it's not ideological, it's spiritual. Because, believe me, there are dark spiritual forces at work. There really are people who are in contact with the other dimension, and there is a spiritual dimension out there. We watch television, we see it, say, on the picture of the medium, where you have a housewife depicted on this very, very popular program who is in contact with the other dimension. And she has dreams, she has all sorts of visions, and everybody takes this as, well, just sort of a matter of fact. You have to understand that the other dimension is real. There is a spiritual dimension, and there are people who are in contact with that, and some of them are working at the highest echelons of our government and of the world government. And if you doubt that, you need to get my letter. It's called The Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. If you can go to our Internet site at radioliberty.com, that's radioliberty.com, and pull down my June newsletter. And don't take what I say. If you want the documentation from their writings, and we take their writings, they publish these things. You're never going to find them in your library, but we have their books, we have their pamphlets, we have their speeches. Read The Occult Hierarchy, Part 2. And if you don't have access to the Internet, that's the June 2005 newsletter. Why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a copy of my newsletter, The Occult Hierarchy Part 2, and you can get The Occult Hierarchy Part 1 on the website. And then, of course, we ask you to tell others about our programs. I remind you, we are going to have an all-day seminar here in Santa Cruz on the 19th of November. And if you can possibly come or get others to come, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, because you have to have a reservation. And then, of course, remember, if you are listening on the Here's Help Radio Network, we do a program there at 12:30 every Saturday if you're listening on a Here's Help radio station. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers, but we specifically ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until we're with you again, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and it was Alex Tocqueville who came to America. And he, writing about the difference between socialism and, as he saw, democracy, he said there's only one thing in common between socialism and democracy, and that is the word equality. But socialism would bring equality by force, and democracy would bring equality by freedom. And that's what this is really all about. There are people who really want socialism that will bring equality by force, and they want to redistribute your wealth. And there's those who believe in, well, freedom. Of course, I would think the republic rather than the word democracy. But certainly, why those of us who believe in individual freedom are in constant war and battle with those who embrace socialism.